but, you know, and she did beat Obama most of the time in 2008, but...
Egypt strikes back, launching airstrikes at Islamic State positions in Libya after militants behead Coptic Christians. Good evening, I'm Gwen Ifill.
And I'm Judy Woodruff. Also ahead this President's Day, getting smart on crime and punishment. A new study finds jails and prisons have become overcrowded warehouses for the poor.
Plus...
Jehovah's Witnesses abhor child abuse of any form.
Breaking the silence. Can freedom of religion trump protections against child abuse? The legal battles with Jehovah's Witness leaders who refuse to shed light on members' dark pasts.
My parents didn't have the power to know that Jonathan Kendrick was a child abuser. Let's give the parents the power to be able to protect their children. And that's what these organizations are hiding.
And Politics Monday with Amy Walter and Nia Malika Henderson. Those are some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
Economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us.
IBEW, the power professionals in your neighborhood. Lincoln Financial, committed to helping you take charge of your life and become your own chief life officer. And by BAE Systems, inspired work.
The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
And
this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Egypt entered the chaos of an ongoing civil war in Libya today to avenge the deaths of 21 Egyptian Christians beheaded by Islamic State militants. Across Egypt, there was overwhelming sadness and anger as a seven-day period of mourning began. Wails and sobs filled the air for the Coptic Christian men beheaded in Libya by the Islamic State. The terror group released a video of their murders Sunday. The men had been abducted in two groups in December and January. 13 of the 21 victims came from the small Egyptian town of El Ur, where along with the sorrow, there was rage.
We are in darkness today. The whole of Egypt is in darkness. Ask them, what have those killed done? What have they done, you dogs? They can only be called dogs.
I demand the international community and President el-Sisi to bring back the bodies of the victims, even if they were thrown in the sea. If they had burnt them, then they should bring us their ashes.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi wasted little time taking action, sending warplanes to eastern Libya overnight to hit Islamic State targets. An ongoing civil war in Libya has created a power vacuum there, providing opportunity for the Islamic State to create its largest branch outside of Syria and Iraq. The vice president of the Libyan General National Congress expressed condolences for the deaths, but criticized Egypt's retaliation.
We strongly condemn the Egyptian assault this morning on the city of Darna, and we consider it a violation of Libyan sovereignty.
At the Vatican, Pope Francis denounced the slayings, saying they were killed simply for the fact that they were Christians. And in a statement released last night, the White House also condemned the killings and said the Islamic State group is unconstrained by faith, sect, or ethnicity. President El-Sisi met with the head of Egypt's Coptic Church to convey his sympathies. His administration later called for international intervention in Libya.
We'll have more on the spread of the Islamic State group right after the news summary.
Authorities in Denmark moved quickly to arrest two men they believed helped the gunman in this weekend's attacks in Copenhagen. The gunman died in a shootout with police and was known to have gang connections. Duncan Golestani of Independent Television News has this report from Copenhagen.
At an internet cafe, two men are arrested on suspicion of helping the man who carried out Denmark's worst terrorist attack in a generation. The police believe they helped hide the gunman between his two shootings and provided the weapon. This is the man they're accused of helping, Omar El Hussein, a violent criminal only released from prison 2 weeks ago. It's thought the 22-year-old may have become radicalized while inside. The head of the Danish intelligence services admitted Al Hussein was on their radar. But the country's prime minister said there was no indication he was part of a wider terrorist cell and called for unity.
This is not a conflict between Muslims and non-Muslims. This is a conflict between the core values of our society and violent extremists.
Al Hussein's attacks were spread over 14 hours. First spraying a cultural centre with bullets, killing a film director, later trying to fire his way into this synagogue. There, El Hussein shot and killed a volunteer guard. Earlier, his family left flowers. Denmark's chief rabbi told ITV News Europe's Jews should not be scared into leaving.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is again calling for a mass migration of European Jews to Israel. This in the wake of the deadly shooting in Copenhagen and after Jewish graves in France were desecrated. But both Denmark's chief rabbi and French President François Hollande rejected the call as ill-timed and insensitive. Hollande was scheduled to visit the vandalized Jewish cemetery tomorrow.
New fighting broke out in eastern Ukraine today, one day after a ceasefire went into effect between Ukrainian troops and Russian-backed separatists. The clash is centered around the strategic town of Debaltseve, a government-held railway hub. The Ukrainian military reported 5 of its soldiers died and another 25 were wounded within the last 24 hours. Both sides now have until early Tuesday to begin withdrawing their heavy weaponry from the front line.
The southern U.S. is no longer being spared the wintry weather. Heavy snow, ice, and freezing rain fell from Missouri to Georgia. Parts of Kentucky could see up to 15 inches of snow by day's end. Meanwhile, New England struggled to recover from its fourth snowstorm in a month. Wind chills dipped as low as 40 degrees below zero in some areas. Residents in Boston dug out from yet another foot of snow overnight as Mayor Marty Walsh appealed for patience.
It's important that we stay focused and not let the frustration get the best of us as we move forward. And I know that a lot of people are just tired and don't know what to do with this amount of snow. And we're in very unusual circumstances.
Forecasters expect the Boston area could get another 8 inches of snow by Thursday morning. A train carrying more than 100 tankers of crude oil derailed south of Charleston, West Virginia today. One of the tankers fell into a nearby river, while 14 others went up in flames along with a nearby home. Snow had fallen in the area, but it was unclear whether that played a role in the derailment. Local residents were told to evacuate. No injuries were reported.
New debt talks for Greece got underway in Brussels today and immediately fell apart. The new Greek government rejected proposals from EU finance ministers on how to deal with their existing bailout deal worth $273 billion. It expires at the end of the month. After the meeting came to its abrupt end, the head of the Eurogroup negotiations said time is running out for Greece to accept its terms.
Given the timelines that we have and parliamentary deadlines, I think we can use this week, but that is about it. If the request for an extension would come in, we would, of course, look at it, ask the institutions to look at it and advise us. And then we could have, if a positive outcome can be envisaged, we could have an extra Eurogroup on Friday.
Thousands of Greeks gathered in front of the parliament in Athens tonight to protest austerity measures. The Greek economy has shrunk by a quarter, and Greek unemployment is above 25%.
Hackers have stolen up to $1 billion from banks around the world in a series of electronic attacks since 2013. The Russian firm Kaspersky Lab presented that finding at a security conference in Cancun, Mexico today. It found the hacking ring has infiltrated more than 100 banks in 30 countries. They use different methods to break in and cap their stealing to $10 million before moving on to another bank.
American teenagers are getting less and less sleep. A new study published today in the journal Pediatrics found that of the 300,000 teens they surveyed, over half didn't get even 7 hours of sleep. That was attributed to early school start times, increased use of social media and electronics, and obesity. Researchers warn sleep deprivation could lead to poor health and academic performance.
Singer-songwriter Leslie Gore died of lung cancer today in New York. Gore's meteoric rise to fame began back in 1963 with her first single, It's My Party, an epic song of teenage longing. She remained at the top of the charts with her follow-up hits, Judy's Turn to Cry and You Don't Own Me. Leslie Gore was 68 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, striking back at the Islamic State, the role of poverty and mental illness in overcrowded prisons, an investigation into sex abuse by Jehovah's Witnesses, Politics Monday with Amy Walter and Nia Malika Henderson, a new book on Robert E. Lee's connection to George Washington, and remembering former poet laureate Philip Levine.
The Islamic State's gruesome attacks in Libya over the weekend raised the specter that the militant group is expanding beyond Syria and Iraq. We take a look now at that with Frederick Wherry of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's recently returned from a trip to Libya. And Michael Leiter, he was the director of the National Counterterrorism Center from 2007 to 2011, and he's now executive vice president at Leidos, a science and technology company specializing in national security issues. Michael Leiter, what are we to take from this particular move into Libya? This seems like an expansion of the footprint we've become familiar with ISIL.
That's right, Gwen, and we've really seen this expansion beyond just Libya. ISIS has, over the past several months, gained some footholds in Egypt to the east in the Sinai Peninsula, as well as smaller elements in Algeria, in Afghanistan, and South Asia. And I think what this fundamentally shows is that we have a message which is resonating extremely effectively with its adherents, and also it's highlighting the real security vacuum that we have in many of these places. And in Libya, that is really most obvious. The breakdown of civil society and government authority in Libya since the fall of Gaddafi in 2011 has allowed, with a lack of security services, elements of ISIS associates, now three different groups in Libya, to really take charge and perpetrate these incredibly gruesome and horrific events.
Frederick Wherry, you're back not too long ago from Libya. Is this something which was, are they taking advantage of this vacuum, as Michael Leiter was discussing just now, that exists because of the internal civil unrest and governance problems that are going on in Libya?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a country that's tearing itself apart. There are essentially two different governments. The country is ruled by a patchwork of militias. You have entire areas of the country that are veritable no-go zones. Some of these areas in the east are longtime hotbeds for extremism. Many of them had al-Qaeda affiliates. What we're seeing now is that the Islamic State is really moving in and is siphoning away a lot of these al-Qaeda folks and moving them over to the Islamic State. It's a very appealing brand right now in Libya.
Michael Leiter, why Coptic Christians? Is it that they were Egyptian? Is that they were Christian? Were they targeted in a particular way?
Well, a little bit of both. Coptic Christians have very regrettably been targeted both in Egypt after the fall of Mohamed Morsi. Many in Egypt believe that the Christians were behind some of that, as well as Coptic Christians have been targeted specifically in Libya before. So they have been under real threat. In my view, Coptic Christians are a even more attractive threat or more attractive target to ISIS than other groups. But in truth, ISIS targets go well beyond Coptic Christians, as we've obviously seen in Iraq and Syria with the burning of the Jordanian pilot. In their view, if you are not strictly aligned with their ideology, be you Muslim, Christian, or something else, you really are one who will be targeted.
Frederick Weary, let's go to Egypt's role in this. How significant is it that they have now been drawn front and center into this growing conflict, if we can call it that, with ISIL?
Well, it's certainly a bold intervention. I mean, airstrikes on these camps in eastern Libya, but it's not the first time that they've been involved in Libya. I mean, last year there were reports of them sending special operations teams across the border. They've been secretly supporting one faction in the civil war, the so-called Dignity faction that is against the Islamists. They've been providing it with intelligence, logistical support. So this is really a visible expression of something that they've been doing for quite some time. Now, will it have any effect? I mean, we know from history that air power alone is not decisive in rooting out these sorts of groups.
Let me go back to Michael Leiter on this, too, because I wonder whether the degree of response is going to create a greater response. Are we now seeing the Islamic State beginning to be kind of a hydra-headed organization that can spray terror wherever it wants? Or is there some sort of goal?
I think, unfortunately, it really has, Gwen. What we were so fearful about really 2-3 years ago as we saw the conflict in Iraq and Syria grow was regional instability. And we are seeing that. We are seeing that with more vehemence and a fight on the Jordanian side into Syria, which is obviously part of our coalition. But now we're seeing that instability spread to North Africa in a very problematic way. And I think it's going to be difficult for the Egyptians not to remain involved and potentially get even more involved. They have this problem, again, to their east in the Sinai, and they have the same problem now to the west. And I think General Sisi views this as a fight that he cannot avoid. And I expect that we will see continued airstrikes. And I don't think it's impossible that we might see some Egyptian troops moving into eastern Libya to try to provide some sort of security space for Egypt.
Frederick Weary, does this complicate the U.S. plan to degrade the Islamic State now that Egypt is involved, or does it back us? Does it give us a little bit more support for that?
Well, it's really conflicted. I mean, on the one hand, they are attacking these camps, but the U.S. position all along has been is that this is a civil war, and that any outside interference, outside support to the warring factions, is unhelpful. The U.S. is supporting a UN-sponsored peace initiative to try to bring the warring factions to the table. And so outside interference, I think, really harms that. So in the long run, I think the defeating the ISIS threat in Libya is best served by a comprehensive peace agreement between the warring factions, coming up with a unity government, unifying the security forces, and then assisting those forces to go after this terrorist threat.
Michael Leiter, what does ISIL, the Islamic State, ISIS, however we're referring to it today, what do they aspire to in these kinds of shocking and riveting actions, especially when they pop up in another country?
Well, they have both tactical and strategic goals. Tactically, they simply believe that it is their duty to kill these individuals. They are so abhorrent to their vision that they deserve to die, and they believe that they are defending their vision of the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim people throughout North Africa and the Middle East. And this is their fight in the same way that ISIL in Syria is also believing that they should also kill people like the Jordanians for bombing them. That's the tactical. But the strategic is still a vision for a broader caliphate, which will be ruled under ISIL's banner. And I think what we see from Libya across to Syria and into Iraq is that this does have some resonance, and it is causing real regional instability, not to mention the threat of individuals who are either inspired by or directed by ISIL who are traveling back to the West, whether we've seen it in France, potentially seen it in Copenhagen. This is a hydra, and it is one that is going to take some time in the region and globally to really effectively counter.
Michael Leiter, Frederick Weary, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. A new report finds that more Americans than ever are spending time in jail. The Vera Institute of Justice showed that in the past two decades, despite a drop in the crime rate, the number of people going to jail has increased dramatically. In addition, those behind bars are staying longer. Some 62% of them have not yet been convicted of a crime. And three-quarters of those jailed now are brought in for nonviolent offenses. The report also finds that a disproportionate number of those in jail suffer from mental illness. Joining us are Nicholas Turner. He is president and director of the Vera Institute, and Margot Schlanger of the University of Michigan. Nick Turner, to you first, why are the jails and prisons of the United States so full today?
Well, you have to go back really almost four decades. We have, since the early 1970s, been on what some people describe as a binge in this country, a reliance on incarceration and on confinement as the primary strategy to keep people safe. That's been the argument. And so for the past 40 years, the number of people in jail and prison in this country has gone up almost 400%. When you look at jails now, there are additional other reasons as to why we have so many people in jail. In the past few decades, we have increasingly arrested more and more people, not only for felonies or serious charges, but also for misdemeanors. And we're also seeing more people who are being arrested being put in jail. So there's a general reflex within the criminal justice system still to rely on confinement.
Well, Margot Schlanger, but overall, as we understand it, the number of arrests is down. So I think it's hard to understand why the prison population has risen so much.
Well, it's always a function of two things. One is who goes to prison, and the answer is a much higher proportion of the people who are getting arrested are going to prison, and then how long they stay there, and they're staying a longer period of time. So prosecutors who used to forego using prison a fair amount are foregoing prison much, much less. And so we have a massive increase in the proportion of people arrested for crimes who go to prison. And that's before you even get to jail, where people are going before they're convicted often, and they're going much more and for much longer periods of time.
And Nick Turner, this report suggests that you've got a much higher percentage of people in prison who are poor and who are mentally ill. I think some of us would say, well, hasn't it always been that way?
Well, I think the thing that is remarkable now is the scale of it. Back in the early 60s, the Vera Institute of Justice, the organization I ran, that I now run, got its start actually looking to solve the problem of people who were locked up in jail simply because they hadn't been able to post bail. We did that, and the lesson spread across the country. But one of the things that's sort of bittersweet about the report that we've written now is, in fact, that this problem very much remains. And actually, in the past two decades, it's gotten a bit worse. So that when you look at people who are in jail right now in this country, and as you stated at the outset of this, about 60% of them are still locked up without having been convicted yet, so they're presumed innocent. A large percent of them are locked up or are unable to get released because they can't post bail. So take New York City, for example, where in 2013, half of everyone who was at Rikers or some of the other detention facilities were there because they couldn't post low rates of bail, $2,500 or less.
Well, Margot Schlanger, this raises a whole set of questions. Number one, the harm done to society by this. But number two, I think what many people are asking is what can be done about it then?
Yeah, I think that the jail problem, bail reform is the easiest thing. Not that it's easy, but it's the thing that we really clearly need. And if we could solve
the bail problem, if we could get people out of jail who haven't been convicted of anything and who are not there because they're a danger, but because they don't have $2,000 to post, we could really make a dent. Solving the prison problem, the problem for people who have been convicted of felonies, that will take a more varied kind of a set of interventions. But I think it's really, right now is a great moment for us to try to make those interventions. And there are, I mean, there are a bunch of them. We need to do parole and probation reform. We need to do reform of the system that allows prisoners good time credit off of their sentences if they are behaving themselves in prison. We need to do community corrections kinds of reforms so that prosecutors have some place to send people when they so that they don't just send them to prison because it's the only option. If we could do all of those things, we could really maybe make a dent and get down from 2.3 million people in jail and prison and get down to something that is historically more typical.
And Nick Turner, Professor Slanger just used the term complex set of solutions. It does sound complicated to accomplish all this. Is this something that realistically can be done?
I think it is, absolutely. So let me make two points about that. I mean, the first is that the report that we wrote came about as part of a Safety and Justice Challenge, which is an initiative undertaken by the MacArthur Foundation, which is encouraging localities around the country, because it's localities, it's cities and counties that run jail systems and that also have the opportunity to figure out how to reduce over-incarceration. And one of the primary reasons why this challenge has been undertaken is because there is a sense of the potential for solution. So I'll make two very quick points about that. One is that there's an absolute necessity. As Margot pointed out, when people are locked up prior to conviction, one of the things that we know is that that detention has very negative consequences for people. There's a higher rate of rearrest post being locked up. There's a higher rate of returning to prison. And for people who have been locked up for even 2 days or so, they're more likely to get eventually sentenced to prison and be sentenced for a longer period of time. So what's really essential is that we figure out how to help people avoid those few days of being locked up. And there are lots of solutions. You can look at options for the police rather than arrest. They can divert people who have a mental health or a substance use problem. You can look at mental health courts or drug courts where treatment is possible. And as Margot said, you can rely less on bail as sort of the ticket out of detention and release people on recognizance, which we have known has been proven to be effective.
Well, I hope that this is something that we can come back to. It's clearly a big subject and one, as both of you suggest, will take some time, but it sounds as if the work is beginning. Nick Turner and Professor Margot Slanger, we thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Next, an investigation into child sexual abuse among Jehovah's Witnesses and accusations that religious leaders led a cover-up within some of the group's 14,000 U.S. congregations. Our colleagues from the Center for Investigative Reporting obtained confidential memos shedding new light on the revelations. Special correspondent Trey Bundy has the story from Reveal, a new website, radio show, and podcast run by the center.
At a convention of Jehovah's Witnesses in California, new members are taking the plunge.
At your baptism, you said yes.
They're joining more than 8 million members worldwide. Believers are taught to renounce secular society because it's controlled by Satan and not to socialize too much with outsiders. But charges of sexual abuse have brought this insular community under greater scrutiny. And now, in this San Francisco courtroom, the first child abuse case against the Jehovah's Witnesses to go to trial is underway.
See, the next matter on the calendar.
Candace Conti is suing the organization for failing to protect her from a known child abuser when she was 9 years old.
If I were to sum up our goals of this case, it was to attack the policies and procedures that were in place that let a serial molester continue to molest children.
Conti's lawyer says instructions from Jehovah's Witness leaders have enabled child molesters.
The instructions were, you keep these pedophiles secret.
The case hinges on letters from Jehovah's Witness leaders to the heads of local congregations. For almost 20 years, they've ordered them to send reports, like this one, for every known child abuser, to hide these cases from their congregations, and not to cooperate with law enforcement or the courts unless instructed to. They've refused judges' orders to turn over these abuse reports, so no one knows how many cases like Conti's are out there.
Jehovah's Witnesses abhor child abuse of any form.
The Jehovah's Witnesses insist that they comply with the law, and their lawyers argue that the First Amendment gives them the right to set child abuse policies as they see fit.
Religious beliefs and standards of Jehovah's Witnesses were at play in this case from start to finish.
The religious beliefs come from the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society in Brooklyn, which has often used the First Amendment to defend its policies of separation. In 1943, it even won a Supreme Court case, arguing that school children should not be forced to pledge allegiance to the flag.
May it please the court, James McCabe on behalf of the North Fremont
Watchtower lawyers, who refuse to speak with us, are again claiming a First Amendment defense to keep child abuse in its congregations secret.
And the elders are counseled in that letter to give special heed to the counsel, do not reveal the confidential talk of another, quoting from the Bible book of Proverbs, chapter 25, verse 9.
Candace Conti was part of a Jehovah's Witness congregation in Fremont, California. She was often grouped with adults to go knocking on doors, including this man, Jonathan Kendrick.
He was very dominating, he commanded a presence.
She says Kendrick would take advantage of their time door knocking to find ways to be alone with her.
Jonathan Kendrick molested me as a child. I really kind of pushed everything down and tried not to think about it as much as I could.
What no one in Conti's family knew was that Jonathan Kendrick had admitted to molesting another child a year earlier.
Regarding possible sexual abuse.
Michael Clark, an elder in the congregation, was asked about it in this deposition.
Do you recall becoming aware of a report of sexual abuse of a child by Jonathan Kendrick?
Yes.
When did you first become aware of such a report?
He had called us to his home to discuss to confess to an incident with his stepdaughter.
Clark never called the police. He followed Watchtower protocol. He wrote to New York headquarters asking how to deal with Kendrick's confession. They told him not to investigate the matter further. Instead, they said, provide him with strong scriptural counsel to avoid a repetition of such a serious offense.
We don't make that public to the congregation. That's confidential.
The elders did not warn other members that one of their own was a child abuser.
That's the policy and the practice of Jehovah's Witnesses that you learned as an elder, correct?
Yes.
Clark says the elders told Kendrick not to be alone with children, but he was still allowed to join in congregation activities that included minors. A year later, one of those minors was Candace Conti.
And I don't think it ever left. I know it never left me. You know, it's always there. And it was just probably one of those days that, you know, I just felt it.
Conti kept quiet about the abuse until years later when she discovered on a sex offender registry that he had gone on to molest another young girl. She decided to sue the Watchtower.
I think after I had found that out, I had this sense of guilt. You know, what if I did something? What if I hadn't been such a coward? What if I had done something to maybe protect this other child? You know, I knew he was capable of, but I didn't do anything. You know, and then now look what happened.
I drove to Oakley, California, where Kendrick had moved when he left Conti's congregation. I met the girl Conti had found. She agreed to talk to us if we didn't show her face.
When I was a little girl, like probably about 6 or 7, Jonathan Kendrick had abused me.
She blames the Watchtower's secrecy for enabling Kendrick to marry into her family and target her. The family sued the Jehovah's Witnesses.
They knew that he had a past, and they kept it from us.
When Kendrick moved to the Oakley congregation, no one was told he was a child molester. Not even Roger Bentley, who served as an elder there for 30 years. He reviewed this letter of introduction from Kendrick's old congregation.
There's no indication at all
that he's guilty of child abuse.
So no mention of child abuse, but any mention of children?
Well, if you read it, it very specifically says he's a very interesting individual who has taken the lead with some young ones in the congregation and helped them from veering off course. That's not a child abuser. That's a recommendation. That's a very specific recommendation. Oh, relax. He's good with kids.
I've spent months trying to interview Watchtower leaders, but they wouldn't talk to me. Instead, they sent a statement saying they comply with reporting laws, they do not shield abusers from law enforcement, and are committed to preventing child abuse. And in one of the dozen lawsuits I've been following, Watchtower supervisor Richard Ash was asked if the organization has a responsibility to protect children from abuse.
But within the congregation, ours is a spiritual protection. When we're talking about physical protection, that's up to the secular authorities to provide. And so
he was asked about the Watchtower's Bible-based directives to keep child abuse cases confidential.
It states in paragraph 3, there is a time to keep quiet when your words should prove to be few. Do you see that?
Yes, sir.
You know, Mr. Joe, object to that violation of the First Amendment, freedom of religion, freedom of association.
The courts continue to grapple with the question, should freedom of religion outweigh the responsibility to protect children? In Candace Conti's case, the jury overrode the First Amendment claims and decided the Watchtower and the North Fremont congregation were negligent and did not adequately protect her from abuse. Kendrick maintains he never molested her. Pending appeal, she was awarded more than $15 million in compensation and damages. It's the first time a jury has ordered the Watchtower to pay for its child abuse policies. But for Kendrick's other victim, her case against the Watchtower was thrown out. Even though Kendrick confessed to the abuse in this deposition and served about 8 months in jail, the judge affirmed that the Watchtower's policies were protected by the First Amendment. It was not liable because the abuse occurred at home and not in the course of religious activity. The Watchtower had no obligation to warn the family about Kendrick's past. Kendrick is now free and still an active member of the Oakley congregation.
The fact that Jonathan Kendrick is still a member of Good Standings is absolutely ridiculous. It's scary. I mean, the fact that he still has access to children. And really, my parents didn't have the power to know that Jonathan Kendrick was a child abuser. Let's give the parents the power to be able to protect their children. And that's what these organizations are hiding.
Despite the huge verdict against the Watchtower, the organization is sticking to its policies. In fact, it just released another confidential memo reminding elders to keep quiet about child abuse. I'm Trey Bundy from Reveal for the NewsHour.
The economy, education, foreign policy, issues already shaping the conversation about who should be our next president. But what else is driving that conversation? For that, we turn to Politics Monday, our weekly check-in with Nia Malika Henderson of The Washington Post and Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. Welcome back.
Thank
again.
You. Great to be here.
I want to go back to those three issues, but also talk about in general what's not on the ballot. We've been spending a lot of time at this table talking about candidates and the people who are thinking about running, who are not thinking about running, but not about what else is driving this, shaping this race right now.
Right. I think there's sort of this overarching theme right now that whether it's domestic or foreign policy, it's this idea of security and stability, which we're really lacking right now. Right. And you could hear it in the 2014 campaign, too. I heard it from voters. I'm sure you guys did, too, when we were out talking to them. The sense that the center isn't holding. Nothing seems to be making sense, whether it's a beheading, whether it is Ebola, Ferguson, school shootings. All of this was coming together for a lot of voters in the sense that nothing seems to be going right. Domestically, again, there are some of the immediate problems, but still the big underlying problem about jobs not coming back, an economy that's doing well for some people, not everybody. So I think that what voters are looking for is somebody to come in and say, I know we have an unstable world that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Let me tell you how I'm going to do that, both internationally, but here at home to to sort of stabilize it and make you feel more secure.
And one of the interesting things about this, it's part of the response to the unanswerable questions, if you're Jeb Bush, for instance, is to say, I'm going to be completely transparent about who I am. And so we've seen a little bit of that from him.
Yeah, we have. He released all of these emails last week in the form of an e-book. We'll see him give a speech on foreign policy on Wednesday in Chicago. He's been asked questions about how he differs from his brother. He has said he doesn't want to relitigate the past in terms of Afghanistan and Iraq. So we'll see him do that going forward. I do think both with him and Clinton, they have to figure out what their identity is vis-a-vis the status quo. Right. The status quo for Clinton, obviously, being Obama, and the status quo for Bush being his brother.
Except for Hillary Clinton, it seems that the real pressure on her is coming from within her own party and from kind of the Elizabeth Warren, once again, not a candidate.
Not a candidate, that's right. That's right. That's right. You see progressives, there was a poll out of Iowa. Warren wasn't in the poll, but if you talk to folks on the ground in Iowa, they very much are dissatisfied with the choices they have. They want to see someone else run. It doesn't look like they will. It looks like Hillary Clinton will have to deal with progressives in whatever way she can, and they won't at least have Elizabeth Warren to channel some of that dissatisfaction.
Except that every time I see any polling, and there's more polling, of course, out today, and I try to stay away from the top line number and just look at the bigger picture number about are people dissatisfied with the choices that they have. And when you looked at these polls out of New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina, even among very liberal voters, they say, yeah, we like Hillary. We're not dissatisfied. Now, Iowa was the one place where they were the least satisfied liberals. But there is not a pining, at least at this point, from the liberal base to bring somebody different in who's not named Hillary Clinton.
Well, but they're all fighting out on all these different fronts. We see them fighting out on education issues, about Common Core, foreign policy, as you mentioned. And here's another place where it's interesting to see them fight it out, kind of, sort of. And that's we saw the FBI director give a speech last week in which he talked about race, something which I think I would have been surprised if I'd seen either this president or this attorney general speak about. Instead of we had the big Irishman get up and speak. Let's listen for a moment.
The Irish had some tough times, but little compares to the experience on our soil of black Americans. That experience should be part of every American's consciousness. And law enforcement's role in that experience, including in recent times, must be remembered. It is our cultural inheritance.
Now, cultural inheritance. Now, that, I can imagine what would have happened on social media if those words had come out of the president's mouth.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's part of this as well, part of just our political environment right now, or if that was just a one-off.
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, this has been part of the debate that we saw in the wake of Ferguson. You saw sort of the Black Lives Matter campaign on social media. Very surprising, though, that this is a Republican. He's a white man. He's the head of the FBI. Mm-hmm. To talk in such a frank way about race, it reminded some people of Eric Holder when he gave that Nation of Cowards speech 6 years ago, also in February. Notable that it's February, notable that we'll probably see more kinds of conversations about race given that it's Black History Month. But where do you go from here, I think, is the question, right? A speech is one thing. Policy and legislation is something else.
I'm trying to figure out who we were watching in this 2016 lineup would pick this up, this cudgel.
Well, we've already seen somebody like Rand Paul pick it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, you have here's a white libertarian from who's very conservative, who is aligning himself and has been doing this for quite some time with African Americans and other Democrats to say we need to do some work on justice reform, on criminal sentencing. And in fact, he talks very much about the fact in the wake of Ferguson, he was one of the few politicians who came out, sort of sounded like Comey when he said, let's just be real clear here. There is a difference in the way that whites and blacks are treated in our justice system.
Final brief thought from both of you on this foreign policy piece. We've talked before about the disabled black people rushing over to London, coming back, not necessarily making the point they meant
very,
to do.
Yeah.
Is all the issues we talked about for the first part of this program, whether it's about Libya or the Islamic State or Ukraine, does that seep into this campaign yet?
Absolutely.
It absolutely has.
Yes, and we've seen that already with these foreign policy trips that are really trade missions, but really foreign policy trips. I think we'll see it with the discussion of the AUMF and authorizing the use of force. We'll see Lindsey Graham on one end, Rand Paul on the other, so very much informed.
And voters, too. It's starting to pop up in polls, too, in terms of their concern with it. And I think for Jeb Bush, his real issue is going to be not so much is he going to go and make statements about ISIS, but how is he going to be different than right. his brother. That's going to be key.
Full circle back to it the security does. Piece. Yeah. Amy Walter, Nia Malika Henderson, thank you both.
Thanks, Gwen.
Thank you.
Now, a new take on Robert E. Lee, the famous Confederate general, with President George Washington as the touchstone. I recently talked with the author of this look at two men who helped shape American history. The Civil War split families, states, and the nation. 74 years after the signing of the Constitution, the United States was torn in two. One of the more conflicted participants in the war was none other than Robert E. Lee, a son of a Revolutionary War hero who was a trusted aide to General George Washington. He married the daughter of Washington's adopted son. At the outbreak of the Civil War, Lee had served 25 years with the U.S. Army. But in April 1861, he turned down an offer to command the Union Army, resigned his commission, and accepted the command of the military and naval forces of Virginia. All this and more can be found in the new book, The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History, by Jonathan Horn, who served as a speechwriter and special assistant to former President George W. Bush. Jonathan Horn, welcome to the NewsHour.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you grew up in the area around Washington. Is that where this interest in Robert E. Lee came from?
That's exactly where this interest came from. If you grow up on the Potomac River, you have so much of Robert E. Lee's and George Washington's history all around you. Robert E. Lee was born in Westmoreland County downriver from Washington, and so was George Washington. Robert E. Lee grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, right near George Washington's Mount Vernon plantation. And Robert E. Lee married his wife at Arlington House, which is that great pillared mansion that's now a cemetery. But back then, it was actually a memorial to George Washington. It was filled with relics of George Washington because, as you mentioned, Robert E. Lee had married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son.
So describe the decision he made that you argue changed American history.
Robert E. Lee actually opposed secession. I think that's a surprise to most people today. But he was actually reading a biography of George Washington as the Union comes apart. And as he's reading this biography, he concludes that the Founding Fathers themselves would have opposed secession. But then he gets this offer. He gets called to Washington by an emissary for Abraham Lincoln, who says, "The country looks to you as the representative of the Washington family to save the Union." And Lee turns down this command because as much as he loves the Union, he can't imagine going to war against his native state of Virginia.
So, I mean, the premise then is that here's this great man who was considered a great hero for the Confederacy in the Civil War. When the moment came for a decision that would matter, he made the wrong one.
That's very much what happened. He forever cast his fate against George Washington's greatest legacy, the Union. And that's ultimately what made me want to write this story, is that tragic tension in Lee's life, how a soldier so associated with George Washington goes to war against George Washington's greatest legacy, the Union.
And he continued to be conflicted about it. You write about what he went through in the periods in the period after that.
Right. And what's amazing is after the war, he actually revises his views. And he starts saying maybe the Founding Fathers hadn't been opposed to secession. And he does try to revisit what happened. He really is tortured. There are lots of descriptions of him with very sad looks on his face, riding his horse after the war, and people wondering, what is he thinking?
You also write, Jonathan Horn, about what he thought about slavery. He wasn't comfortable with it, but he did, in the end, defended it. He kept slaves. You even tell a really remarkable story. You quote someone as describing a scene where he himself whipped a female slave who had tried to escape when one of his employees said he couldn't do it.
Right, and that's one of the most controversial moments in Robert E. Lee's life. We don't exactly know what happened there. He denied that story. But what's so interesting is what most entangled Robert E. Lee in the institution of slavery, because he really didn't want to be involved with it. He wanted to stay away from it. We shouldn't make the mistake of thinking he was an abolitionist. He certainly was not. But what happens is his father-in-law, who is George Washington's adopted son, dies and leaves a will naming Robert E. Lee as executor of estates. And those estates actually include slaves who have descended from Mount Vernon, George Washington's home. So on the eve of the Civil War, Robert E. Lee is managing slaves who have direct connections to the father of our country.
You write not only about the decision that he made to join the Confederacy, but about decisions he made as a general. I mean, he has a reputation as a brilliant general. It's the reason that both the North and the South went after him. But in the end, when you look at the decisions he made as a general, was he a great general?
He was a brilliant military mind. And what's so interesting about Lee is we have this impression of him always taking the initiative in battle, even though his forces were outmanned and outgunned. But he never saw it that way. He always thought he had no choice. He had to take incredible risks because the odds against him were so stacked. And so the way we view Lee today isn't necessarily the way he viewed himself.
Was there a chance that with Lee in charge in the South could have prevailed?
Absolutely. I don't think we can say anything is inevitable. If those Union soldiers hadn't held Cemetery Ridge at Gettysburg, who knows what would have happened? I think one of the lessons I took away from this book is that nothing is inevitable in history. History turns on the decisions of single individuals all the time, and we shouldn't ever make the mistake of thinking that history is inevitable.
Well, it is a fascinating book, whether you are into Civil War history or not. It's The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. Jonathan Horn, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Finally tonight, remembering the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and former poet laureate, Philip Levine. He died this weekend from pancreatic cancer at the age of 87. Levine, who worked as an auto worker in Detroit, wrote with distinction about working-class life in the industrial heartland. He eventually published more than 20 volumes of verse and earned a place as one of the country's honored poets. Jeffrey Brown profiled him in 2010. Here's a look. It starts with Levine reading one of his poems about waiting in line for factory work.
We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Fort Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision. Until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. When I was a young guy working in these places and didn't see a way out as yet, and I certainly didn't think the way out would be poetry.
What were you doing?
Usually five people would take an enormous piece of hot steel, which four of us would hold with tongs and put it into a huge press.
So what was poetry then? I mean, where did the poetry come from?
No one knows where poetry comes from. I had been writing poetry from the age of 14. It was just something I loved doing. I loved language. I recognized that I had a facility for it. My teachers praised me to the skies, which was wonderful. Well, one thing I was struck by very young, in my middle 20s, very young, was that I didn't see any work, written work, about this experience. As far as poetry, zero. So I actually did at one time say to myself, hey, there's a whole world here no one's touched.
And this should be a subject for poetry.
It should be there. Yeah, it should be there.
Many years later, you've made a life as a poet. Does that surprise you?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I'm stunned to be honored as a poet, even if not by a nation, because a nation is an abstraction, but just to be honored by this person or that person, or especially by your wife or your brothers or your mother, father. I mean, it's just fantastic. It keeps you going in a way that nothing else could keep you going.
You can watch the full profile online, plus find more videos of Levine discussing and reading his work. That's at pbs.org/newshour.
Again, the major developments of the day. Egypt launched airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Libya after the militants beheaded 21 Coptic Christian hostages. Authorities in Denmark arrested two men they believed helped the lone gunman who killed two people in this weekend's attacks in Copenhagen. And cyclist Lance Armstrong was ordered to pay $10 million in a fraud dispute to the sports insurance company that paid his bonuses for winning the Tour de France. Armstrong will appeal the arbitration ruling.
On the NewsHour online right now, what would you give up to be a part of the first mission to Mars? 100 candidates will compete for a chance to help establish humankind's first foothold on the red planet. Read about the privately funded Mars One mission and the potential explorers who would go, knowing they could never return to Earth. Also on this President's Day, take our Commander-in-Chief beard quiz. We ask you to match the man to the mutton chops. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour.
Did you take the quiz?
I'm not taking that one.
Did you not take it? I passed. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. On Tuesday, the price of gold, from child labor to toxic chemicals. We dig into the hazardous conditions in the mines for the precious metal. I'm Gwen Ifill.
And I'm Judy Woodruff. We'll see you online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
From a World of Darkness. We became a nation of light. A nation powered by electricity. A nation powered by the IBEW. IBEW, powering North America.
BNSF Railway. And by BAE Systems, inspired work. Lincoln Financial, committed to helping you take charge of your life and become your own chief life officer.
And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting science, technology, and improved economic performance and financial literacy in the 21st century.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.